This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Ruler is the world's finest magazine of cycling and cycling culture. Established in 2006, Ruler interviews the world's biggest cycling names and covers the world's biggest cycling races. Visit our website at ruler.cc and subscribe to support our in-depth features, long reads, independent journalism, stunning photography and immersive cycling coverage. I'm Edward Pickering. I'm the editor of Ruler and this is Ruler Conversations. Spring is here, which means it's classic season in the world of cycling. The two big stage races of March, Paris-Nice and Tirreno-Adriatico, have concluded. And while there's plenty more for the stage races to go out through March and April with the Volta a Catalunya and Itzulia Basque Country, the main focus of the cycling world for the next 6 weeks or so will be the great one-day races of Europe. By the end of April, the World Tour peloton will have tackled four monuments. That's Milan-San Remo, the Tour of Flanders, Paris-Roubaix and Liège-Bastogne-Liège, as well as many more prestigious events like Gent-Wevelgem, Amstel Gold, E3 Saxo Bank Classic, Flèche Wallonne and more. There's no Milan-San Remo for the Women's World Tour, but Trofeo Alfredo Binder takes place in Italy the same weekend. We're going to talk classics, especially Milan-San Remo, in this edition of Ruler Conversations. But first, we are going to catch up with James Start, Ruler's staff photojournalist, to talk about Paris-Nice, where he spent a week taking photographs from the back of a race moto. So, James, it looked like you experienced every single season and every kind of weather between Paris and Nice in that week.
Yeah, I most certainly did, but that's really what I love about Paris-Nice. You start outside of Paris and you cross through the heart of the entire country, and then you finish up on the spectacular Mediterranean coast with an action-packed weekend over the back hills of Nice. And it's just, it's a stunning race. Every day is a different day. It's different weather, it's different terrain, it's different landscapes, it's different style of racing. And I kind of fell back in love with it this year.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think it's one of the most, it's probably my favorite one-week stage race of the year, just because of that sense of a journey and that moving from place to place, from landscape to landscape, from culture to culture, and from one of France's great cities to another one of France's great cities with everything in between. So on a racing level, it was relatively straightforward, and the structure was that there were some sprint stages, a TTT, and then it hit the hills. Tim Merlier and Mads Pedersen won first two stages in bunch sprints, a smaller bunch sprint. Jumbo Visma won a very innovative team time trial on the third day of the race. In between that, there was another flattish stage won by Olav Kooi on stage five. But it was stages 4, 7 and 8, mountainous or middle mountainous stages, all won by Tadej Pogačar, who went on to win the overall. And then there's one stage lost to cancellation with the wind. So let's go through those stages, James. Those first couple of stages on the flat, how are they for you?
Well, they're interesting. I mean, the results may have come up as, you know, sort of typical stage sprints, right, as they were designed. The first stage could have been very tricky if the winds had been stronger, but they weren't, and it was a more typical day. The second day, however, the winds were picking up, and you could already see Pogačar was already on the tack. I mean, as soon as that pack was in a crosswind, UAE was one of the teams driving at the front, and Pogačar was taking his poles. I mean, he took a lot of poles. as they were trying to split the race up, he was clearly came into this race knowing that this race can be won in seconds. It often is. And he wanted to get every second he could. The winds weren't strong enough, but it was telling how hungry he was. And he was already going for like bonus sprints and things like that. So Jumbo won it by a second over EF. UAE finished, I think it was 23 seconds down, but Tade only lost about 10 or 12 seconds because he had already picked up bonus seconds. So it was like, even on the GC level, it was all out racing from the get-go. It was really fascinating.
That TTT was unusual in that the riders basically got the time they finished on. The team didn't get the time of the fourth rider across the line, as normally happens. If they finished in the same time as the first rider, they all got the same time. But otherwise, everyone got the same time, didn't they? And Pogacar effectively had his own race at the end there, didn't he? He was the first rider home from UAE by some distance.
They're playing with it, and it got generally high marks. People thought it was pretty innovative, and the riders' teams, nobody seemed to be resisting it. So we'll see where that goes. But it was certainly interesting. And, you know, and kudos to ASO for trying to come up with innovative ways to reinvent these classic races. They've been doing it at the Tour for years, and here's a case where they tried to do it at Paris-Nice. It was a tremendous race all over, and you know, Tade obviously was just all over the race. It was really impressive to see. I'll be honest with you, I was sitting there watching him this week, and if you look at it on paper, Tade dominated. He won all three climbing stages, but he won against the really big riders. I mean, he won against the reigning Tour de France champion, the guy who unseated him with a strong team. He won by winning three stages over a tremendous field. And it just hammered home what a tremendous talent he is. And I honestly, watching that, I was sitting there going, is he really not the next Eddy Merckx? I mean, he's the most complete champion that we know. I mean, he's already won Liège. We're going into the classics here. And he could be a factor in a lot of these classics. He could be a factor at Milan-Sanremo. He could be a factor at Flanders. And he can, of course, then be a factor in Liège. He's unreal.
So the story of Pogacar's race was that he was, you know, nicking seconds in bonus sprints early on in the race, but he dropped everyone apart from David Gaudu at La Loge des Gardes, but, you know, put significant time into Jonas Vingegaard. On the Col de Quillol, again, he won ahead of Gaudu and Vingegaard, a bit closer this time, but, you know, he didn't need to do anything. And then the final day, it was just demonstration of how far superior he was to the rest of the field. He rode everybody off his wheel on the Col d'Ez coming back into Nice. And really, James, there was only one story in town, wasn't there? It was just a very, very dominant ride by a man who's clearly got a point to prove this year.
Well, he does, and he hammered it home. I mean, this is a rare matchup between two huge rivals, the two riders who've won the last three Tours de France. A lot of times those guys kind of eye it up and try to sort of avoid each other throughout the season. And they went head to head in the second biggest stage race in France. They went head to head and Tade made a strong impression. Obviously, Vingegaard is going back, going, I got my homework to do. I got a lot of homework to do. I don't just have to deal with Pogacar. Now I got Gaudu, who is clearly better than him. So a lot of stories and sub-stories. You know, you got Gaudu, who got fourth last year in the Tour de France, just starting to think and realize how good he could be.
How did Pogacar look close up in the race?
He just, the guy is so, you know, he's very happy-go-lucky. He never seems to be stressed. I don't think I've ever seen him grimace. And he rides so well. I mean, Cyril Guimard, he still reads a race really well. And he just said, you know, Tade rides so smart. He doesn't crash very often. He doesn't get caught behind the wind, the splits in the wind. He knows where he needs to be, when he needs to be, and he seems just to do it effortlessly. He never seems to panic.
And did you get a sense of how the dynamic was between Vingegaard and Pogacar? Because it's very interesting at last year's Tour. It was all handshakes and smiles, but it must have been difficult for Pogacar to deal with getting defeated in the biggest race in the world. How was it at Paris-Nice with the tables being turned back again?
Well, you saw a little bit already on the first stage, like about 5K from the finish, there was a little a bonus sprint, or was I think a KOM, and they went away. But Vingegaard wasn't going to pull. I think Vingegaard came into this race defensive, going, I've got the superior TTT team. I'm going to win it there and put Pogacar on the defensive. He didn't want to play into Pogacar's hand. And Pogacar was, you know, kind of frustrated. He showed his frustration because he likes to race bikes. And he was just racing full on, going for every bonus second all along. And Vingegaard was not. Now, it was also interesting because, you know, last year, Pogacar on the tour obviously had one bad day and made some mistakes because he was always going on the attack. And here, it was on that first climbing stage, it was Vingegaard who made the mistake. Pogacar had his teammate on the front driving the pace going up the climb. They were going hard. Vingegaard no longer had any teammates. And what does he do? He attacks. You don't attack Tadej Pogacar when he's still got a teammate left. Pogacar's team kept the tempo high until, you know, until Vingegaard started to stabilize, and then he jumped across. One thing I will say, you know, what he did here, he did in a week. He did that last year in the week, that in a week-long Tour de France. He looked unbeatable that first week in the Tour, the first 10 days maybe. But then, you know, it caught up to him. He had never had a chance in a week-long stage race for all those attacks, all those accelerations to catch up to him. There's still a question mark out there. Has he learned his lesson from last year when you're looking at a three-week race? We'll find out.
And how did Vingegaard deal with being on the receiving end?
He was clearly frustrated every time he crossed that finish line. He was frustrated at La Loge des Gardes. You could see him shaking his head. You could see him shaking his head in Col de la Cuillole. By the finish yesterday on the promenade, you know, he was just beaten. I mean, he was just clearly beaten. Pogacar just rode away from everybody on the Col d'Huez. I mean, that's a hard climb. And we went up a different way, a much steeper back road, and it was really steep. And he just said, okay, I'm going now. Bye. So I think by the end of that week, he was pretty resigned.
There must be a growing sense of excitement around David Gaudu in France, because he managed to stick with Pogacar on the two significant uphill finishes. Couldn't quite match him on the Col d'Huez, I guess, but the French must be thinking, you know, he's on an upward trajectory and he's already come fourth in the Tour de France. And it's not at all a leap of imagination to think that he could envisage being on the podium this year.
I think he's a very strong podium candidate. I mean, Gaudu's a very good rider. Gaudu won the Tour de l'Avenir, which is what Pogacar won when he was still in Espoir. I mean, that is the key stage race for all the Espoirs, the under 23s. Both of them are winners there, and everybody who wins that race goes on to have a significant career. Bernal won that race. So Gaudu has been, you know, just steadily improving, and he's showing it more and more. But he's got this one, you know, he can't rival those guys in the TT. And so it's really going to depend. If he actually wants to go beyond the podium, it's going to depend on a lot of things. It's going to depend on the Tour de France route. It also will depend on the circumstance of the races. You know, not unlike, say, Romain Bardet a few years ago. You know, if the other guys are looking at each other, he might be able to capitalize. But that's what he did on the La Loge des Gardes. He could see that they were playing off against each other. And when they started marking each other, he's the one who actually launched the winning attack. And then Pogacar was going, wait a minute. Make no doubt. And he said in the press room, make no doubt about it. David Gaudu is one of the world's best climbers. So he knew he had to cover him as well. And he did. And then they put 30 seconds into Vingegaard right there.
Gaudu's teammate Thibaut Pinot famously didn't enjoy the attention and pressure that was put on him by the French media and French public at the Tour de France. Is Gaudu equipped to deal with that pressure?
I think so. A bit like Pogacar, he does not get his feathers ruffled very easily. You know, there's been this whole brouhaha around the team. I can't see him showing any signs of stress. I mean, I've known him since Tour de l'Avenir, and he always, you know, always says hello, and he still does. You know, I mean, he's a pretty relaxed guy. He's got his head on, and he's got a close group of family and friends that he can filter things through, and he's very close to his roots in Brittany. I think he knows who he is and what he can be, and he's not going to get ruffled by that.
And then on an overall level, kind of impressionistically, how did this edition of Paris-Nice work for you in comparison with other editions?
It was great. I was, like I said, I was very happy to go back from a visual standpoint because the visual narrative here is just tremendous going all the way through the country from Paris down to Nice. So every day provided different challenges. That's, you know, some days more successful than others from a visual standpoint. Some days concentrated a little bit more on the racing, you know, whatever. Some days there was more opportunities for postcards. I like mixing it up, doing both, because that's what I consider to be real storytelling. A lot of fans along the road. I was really happy to be back there.
James, thanks for your insight into Paris Nice. We're going to have a very short break, and then we're going to talk about Milan San Remo. I'm interrupting this podcast to remind all listeners to subscribe to Roulair. Roulair is the world's finest magazine of cycling and cycling culture. We feature the work of the best writers in cycling, along with the very best photography, elegantly laid out and printed on high-quality paper. Our deep dives into road racing, gravel, adventure cycling and life on two wheels are immersive, independent, agenda-setting and thought-provoking. We aim to educate, entertain, inform and inspire. Our latest magazine, out now, is Roulair 117, the body issue. One of the most fascinating things about road racing is that it is accessible to so many different body shapes. Basketball players are tall, distance runners are slight. But cyclists can be tall, short, stocky, skinny, and everything in between. And outside the sport, anybody can cycle. To paraphrase René Descartes, I cycle, therefore I am a cyclist. Roulair 117 features an exclusive interview with Julien Alaphilippe, the double world champion. Alaphilippe is one of the most physical cyclists in the World Tour. His riding style is expressive and hides nothing. We knew we had to have him in the magazine. Also featured in Roulair 117, in-depth interviews with Theo Gegenhardt, Lizzie Banks and Matthias Skelmius. Cultural critic and cycling journalist Kate Wagner reflects on the sport's relationship with pain and suffering. And Roulair Italia editor Emilio Previtali reflects on what cycling has in common with the Japanese art of kintsugi. There's also a fascinating interview with Instagram content creator Beau Markson, whose honesty and battle with body dysmorphia is an inspiring tale. Beau posts on Instagram with the handle @dadbod_cyclist. Roulair 117 is available now. To support our journalism and receive a magazine every 6 weeks, please subscribe. Go to roulair.cc, hit the subscribe button and enter the code podcast15. That's podcast15 to get 15% off our regular subscription price. And now, back to the show. It's become fashionable for cycling fans and pundits to make a statement about when the season begins for them. For some, it's the Aussie Nationals in the first week of January. For others, it's the Tour Down Under, or the GP Marseillaise, or the Tour of Mallorca. Others are adamant that they don't get out of bed for anything before Omloop Het Nieuwsblad. But though I've always felt that Paris-Nice is where I really start watching cycling in earnest, there's a good argument that it is under the azure skies of the Mediterranean coast in Liguria and the swooping coastal road of Milan-San Remo that the business end of the season really begins. Milan-San Remo, the first of the monuments, is known as La Primavera, which is Italian for spring, and it's got an atmosphere all of its own. It's the longest race on the World Tour at 300 kilometres, and its rhythm and shape are quite unlike any other event. Apart from the marathon distance, there's nothing on the parkour that particularly stands out as a challenge. There's a steady grind over dozens of kilometres to the Turchino Pass before the flat coastal road. The finale consists of three small climbs, Capo Melle, Capo Cerva and Capo Berata, then two longer climbs, the Cipressa and Poggio. If this finale was put into a race of 150 or 200 kilometres, there'd probably be a reduced bunch sprint every time. As it is, in my opinion, the finale of Milan-San Remo is the most tense, finely balanced and unpredictable of the season. It's equally possible to envisage a bunch sprint, a reduced bunch sprint, a group sprint or a solo win, and it's only in hindsight that we find out who got it right. Sometimes the favourite wins, sometimes they don't. But it never quite happens the way we thought it would, and if you had to say what the correct strategy was for Milan-San Remo, it would be that the winner is the rider who identifies their opportunity when it comes. Think Matej Mohoric attacking over the Poggio descent last year, or Jasper Stuyven using the very last part of the same descent to attack into San Remo in 2021, or Vincenzo Nibali attacking over the Poggio in 2018. The excitement partly comes from that release of the slow build-up of tension over the course of the day. You can't have that finale without the build-up, And the unpredictability and fine balance of the outcome is demonstrated by the fact that there hasn't been a multiple winner of La Primavera since Oscar Freire took his third victory in 2010. In the last 12 editions, there have been 12 different champions. But even beyond the excitement of the race, Milan-San Remo is one of the focal points of the cycling season. Its long history is part of that, but it's also just a pleasure to watch, for its scenery, for the sense of a journey, for the knowledge that Italian cycling culture is so deep and textured, and for what it teaches us about patience and picking our moments. Emilio Previtali is the editor of Ruta Italia, an accomplished mountain climber, skier and triathlete, and also a writer who always conveys passion and the joy of exploration. So, Emilio, tell us about the place that Milan-San Remo has in Italian cycling culture.
Well, as maybe the people already know, it's just the beginning, you know. It's the moment when there is the primavera. La primavera is the moment when everything is starting. And so Italy is the country of the sun, of the summer, I would say. And so it's a moment of joy. It's not just a race, but it's a moment where people go on the road and see people around. So this is really the beginning. I would say that the beginning is the word we need to use.
So tell us a bit about the region, or, well, regions. It's such a long race that the race takes place in. Like, this is different from where Strade Bianche takes place in Tuscany, for example.
Yeah, it's completely different because you start from Milan, and this year will be in Albiategrasso, but the region in Lombardia there is a lot of industry, a lot of traffic, and then you go south and you go to the Riviera. I mean, you go to Genova, to the sea. And in that way, it's also, again, a kind of beginning, because you come from the winter where it's foggy, it's cold. I mean, I think that Milano is a bit like London, could be like a town where there is cloud. I mean, there is noise. And you go in south, and south you have some space, the light, the bright color of the sea. And so it's the moment when people also like to start to go to the sea and for the weekend. And so, again, I would say that is, in a metaphoric way, is a kind of beginning of the season, of the sea season. Liguria is great. Liguria is great. It's great food, sea, wonderful landscape. And the reason why the people from Milan, they like to go in the region.
So with the Tour of Flanders and Paris-Roubaix and the classics in Belgium, they're kind of an expression of Flemish pride. Does Milan-San Remo tell us anything about Italy and Italian people, or people from that region?
I would say that Italy is not is a relative small country, but the region, you really feel the difference between the places, the languages. For example, in Italy, we have so many languages, from Milan to Genova. They speak two different languages, because in Milan, they speak Milanese, and in Genova, they speak in another way. So basically, there is a kind of proud from the people from Milan, because in one side, the race is starting from Milan, the town of the where people is going for work, and is arriving in San Remo. And this is a place where in the past, people was going there for the winter. So the old and rich people was living there in the winter to have a season, a winter a little bit better. So there is a proud of the people living in Lombardia. And again, is the proud of the people living in Liguria, because they know they live in a really beautiful place and they have that pride to be there.
So on a sporting level, Milan-San Remo is a little unusual in cycling here. It's 300 kilometres long. It's the longest race in the World Tour. It takes 6 or 7 hours. And for a long time, nothing happens. You know, there are no big mountains or anything. You could even say that it looks a little anachronistic and out of time. But at the same time, it's the most finely balanced sporting competition there is, isn't it?
Yeah, I would say that is magic, because looks like anything is happening for the race. And then when you are in the final, in the last, I would say 1 hour and a half, is every when everything is going to happen. And in a way, this is a really old race. You need to know that the Sanremo at the beginning was for runners. I mean, the beginning of the race was not for cycling, was for runners. And then transformed in cycling. And the race is really old because, of course, it's super old. But at the same time, it's really modern, I would say, because like we are used to see the races now really sprinting at the end, the last hour of the race is super tight. And so this is the format that at the same time is so long, but is so concentrated at the end. So the magic of the Sanremo is that everything is happening when you are cooked, when your legs are gone. I mean, you feel like nothing is happening, but at the end you did almost 250 kilometers before to start the dancing.
And finally, does this race resonate culturally beyond the cycling world with Italians? You know, do all Italians or all Italian sports fans watch it, or is it more for the cycling fans?
Both, I would say, like because it's for the people that are really passionate for cycling. So it's a classic to go there and see on the Poggio what's going to happen. The crowd there on the very last turn when you, then you have to go down, it's crazy. But at the same time, on TV, you watch the TV and you understand that the season is coming, you know. And so also the people not really into cycling, they like to know who is going to win. You need to know that Sanremo is also a place where every year in spring, like 1 month early, there is the Festival di Sanremo. It's a really famous festival for music. And so you really have that feeling that something is going to happen. It's coming. So there is the festival and then there is the Sanremo race. And so after that, we know that we are in the primavera.
It looks like Sanremo is the place to be in mid-March, both for cycling fans and fans of wider culture. Emilio, thank you so much for your insight. Last question, who is going to win on Saturday?
I don't know, because the race is so crazy. I would like to say Ganna, because Ganna is maybe time. I'm saying Ganna because I'm Italian, but I think the race is super, super open.
James Start is Ruler's photojournalist, and he's going to be on a race moto this year at Milan-San Remo. And we've been talking just before the break about Paris-Nice and how there's that sense of a journey. So, James, tell me about the journey you have from Milan to San Remo.
In terms of the one-day races, it's probably the greatest, you know, because you go from the northern plains all the way down to the Italian Riviera, and with that, you know, splendid last 100 kilometers, 150 kilometers, along the Mediterranean. And then that always that just, I think it's, you know, it's one of the great finishes in bike racing. So it's a race I truly love. For me, it's right up there with Paris-Roubaix, Strade Bianchi. I mean, these are for me just the most beautiful races in the world, the most beautiful one-day races, because they all just have such a strong visual narrative. And I'm really looking forward to being on that bike. It's the first time actually I've been on a moto in Milan-San Remo.
What's your experience been of the atmosphere at the race?
What I love about Milan-San Remo, I always consider it sort of like a haiku painting or something. You know, there's this long moment, these, you know, maybe even hours of reflection, and then this spur of activity and creation and inspiration and high drama. And then all of a sudden it's over and your piece of art is there before you. And it's always a great race. It's always a great, memorable story at the end.
Do you get a sense that there's a strong relationship between the local people and the race itself?
Well, it's in Italy, and Italians love cycling. So it has a very special connection to Italy and the Italians, and it's part of their DNA. And you see it, and these are not highly, a lot of these towns that they're going through are not highly populated towns at this time of year. A lot of these things are, you know, beach resorts and stuff. So it's not like July in the Tour de France or even, you know, certain stages on the Giro, but the people are there.
Do you watch the whole race when you're watching it as a fan?
I watch as much as French television would allow me to, but I certainly, you know, like as soon as they've come through the Ticino, I just love watching them meandering along that coast and through those towns and watching the tension mount and those first climbs. And I am truly enamored with Milan-San Remo.
I guess it's got a unique aesthetic, hasn't it? Because, you know, that coastal road with the Mediterranean on one side and the cliffs on the other just lends itself to good photography, doesn't it?
especially when the sun is out. And I'm really crossing my fingers we have the same sun we had this weekend in Paris-Nice. But yes, it's spectacular. I cannot wait to see what it gives me. The images from that last 150K are truly spectacular. What a stage for a bicycle race. That's really, as a photographer and somebody who's been covering the sport for 30 years, that is such an important part for me in what makes a successful bike race, is the stage that it presents to the riders.
Well, we're looking forward to seeing your pictures from the race, James, and I hope those 7 hours on the back of the moto pass as quickly as they can.
I am too. That's my only hesitation, is how my back's going to hold up.
Steve Cummings is a director sportif at Ineos Grenadiers. As a professional cyclist, he won stages of the Tour de France and Vuelta, the GC in the Tour of Britain, and multiple national titles. He rode Milan-San Remo 6 times with a best position of 38th in 2017, and he spent a large part of his career living in Italy. So, Steve, what was your impression of the race as a rider?
I guess like living in Italy, passion. I don't know if it's the history of the race. Passion, it's so fast and it just builds and builds and builds. I don't think there's a race. I think it's quite unique where it builds towards the end. I can't take my eyes off it when I watch it the last sort of 50, even more now, 60, 70K. It's an incredible race. It's never an anticlimax, put it that way. It's always just builds and builds and builds to that last moment.
And what's it like to be in the middle of it all? I guess you're never much more tired than you were 5 minutes ago. It's just that keeps on adding, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's just intense. Like the fight for position already from after Ticino, the downhill, there's a bit of a fight there. You have to be in good position. And then along the coast, as you move, you cross all those Capoberto, Capomelli, and then the race into Cipressa is just full gas, full like sprint lead up trains really. And the way the road twists along the coast and squeezes in the towns, the speed is just so high. And then obviously Cipressa, often they hit it so fast and everyone's a bit gassed, there can be a bit of a lull, but other times you just never know, someone will hit it and hit it really hard from the bottom, try to reduce the group. And then there's always a fight again then for downhills at the top of the climbs, because position's so important, it all gets so strung out, the elastic band, and if you're not in the right place, it's difficult to come back to the front before the Poggio. And it's the same thing on the Poggio, full gas. Everyone races for the downhill. You get that concertina, and maybe someone who's a bit further back gets a little sling, work their way back up to the front, or attack. Yeah, it's a pretty cool race.
And what are the physical attributes you need to be able to do well in it?
I used to have to do around 450 to 470 watts on Cipressa. I think it's around 15 minutes. And then even more on the Poggio. But I never want to see any more again. you need to be able to obviously cope with that, the sprinters. I think it's interesting because the sprinters, obviously, they're probably better at positioning than some of the other riders, like the climber guys, so they can find themselves in better position at the start of these climbs and sort of slip back, and then maybe the climbers come in front. So if you want to win, you need to be very good downhill, very good at positioning, obviously have the power, the explosive power. I think Poggio, 5 minutes or something like that, so you need to have a huge power to get over that. And then if you're not alone, you need the explosive sprint at the end, really.
And at 300 kilometres, it's such a different challenge from most other races. Did you have to prepare specifically, or do you just have to kind of improvise with what you've got because it's a one-off?
It's 300K, but in terms of time, it depends a little bit on the conditions, but in terms of time, it's normally around, like, it's getting faster and faster, it seems. But 6.5 hours, up to 7 hours, so it's like half an hour at tops extra than you would a normal classic race. So I don't think there's anything specific you do for it. If you, I used to train 6 hours once a week, so I was kind of thereabouts, and I suspect many of those classic riders do the same. So it's just that last hour or even half an hour, depends on the conditions. Nothing specific, I would say.
And would you say it's a race that's better designed for sprinters, or is it more of a puncher's course these days?
I'm not sure you can say. I think it depends a little bit how the race goes. The last few years, yeah, it's been great. You've seen these attacks on the Poggio, and they've been sticking to the final. So it seems to have gone in trends. Before that, there was quite a few sprinters winning from groups, but at the moment, there's like a group of really punchy riders. Van der Poel, Van Aert, Pidcock, Alaphilippe, and yeah, they all want to try and get rid of the sprinters. So it seems to have become a bit more of a punchers race the last few years.
And the perception is that the course is, you know, is pretty flat. It's not got really long climbs. The climbs aren't super steep, but at the same time, it just seems to have something that makes it hard.
I think it's that intensity, the fight for position, and how fast they go up those climbs, really. Yeah, the first part of the race is pretty easy, but then when you look at the demands of what it takes that last hour and a half of racing, it's so, so intense that it's not easy.
Do you see it differently as a DS than you did as a rider?
I haven't actually DS'd it. Yeah, it's interesting. We're just speaking about it now on a call. It's important you get the right balance within the team, and I think going back to what we were saying earlier about is it a sprinters or a punchers race, ideally you'd have a rider who could do both, so you've got a rider, you protect two guys and one can sort of follow any attacks on a Poggio, and then you've got a fast man in case it all comes back together who can do the sprint. I think that would perhaps be the ideal scenario for a team, and then you need your guys who are doing the job, bringing the guys into Chipresa, taking care of the riders along the coast, and then some riders who can do the final work into the Poggio. Yeah.
And lastly, do you get a sense of the importance of the race in Italian cycling culture?
Definitely, yeah. It's massive. Everyone talks about that in Italy, and everyone talks about the Giro. So they're the two big things. And I think everyone watches it there in Italy. It's a beautiful race to watch along the coast. And as I say, the last hour, it's hard to take your eyes away from the TV.
Pete Cozzins is a cycling journalist of many years' experience who has edited Pro Cycling, is currently a member of the writing collective La Course en Tête, and has authored many books on the sport, including The Monuments, The Grit and Glory of Cycling's Greatest One-Day Races, which has just been updated and re-released. The Monuments is a great read and gives an insightful history of all five of the biggest one-day races. But it's chapter 4, Milan-San Remo, that we're going to talk about here. So first of all, Pete, it's the first monument of the year. How come it's chapter 4?
Well, I did it in the order that they were actually founded. I mean, I kind of thought I should have started with San Remo. But of course, then you get to the point where San Remo was founded in 1905, I think. That was the first running. And Liège-Bastogne-Liège was already a teenager by then. In 1892, the first edition of Liège-Bastogne-Liège. And Paris-Roubaix had been founded before. And they'd also been, Lombardy had been founded before as well. So San Remo was the fourth one to come into line. So that's why it was slotted in there, just kind of chronologically, I guess.
So what's the history of those? How did it start up?
Well, like a lot of these things, it was down to kind of local businessmen in San Remo. They wanted to put San Remo on the map. There was a bit of a rivalry between San Remo and Monte Carlo, as it was sort of generally known. Now we call it Monaco, just in terms of attracting kind of the royalty, the aristocracy of in the late 19th century, early 20th century. They were looking at ways of kind of putting San Remo kind of more to the forefront. And they'd actually, the year before, I think it was, they'd done a car race from Milan to San Remo. It was an absolute disaster. I think barely anybody finished. I think only one car finished, if I remember rightly. And then they kind of came up with this second scheme. Well, let's do a bike race. And this was in, like I say, in 1905. And yeah, it was off and running then.
And what is it about Milan-San Remo that stands out for you?
It's, I think it's the same as for everybody. It's the length of it that's just astonishing. It's a real throwback to what cycling was like, a 300-kilometre race. It's kind of a bit like playing golf nowadays with Hickory golf clubs. It's an anachronism. Nobody would come up with a race like this anymore. It doesn't sit well in the modern era for a lot of people, I suppose. I found it really hard to love initially. I love it now because I've written about it a lot and I kind of come to understand it. And it's just got real significance. It's got real resonance for me. I mean, it isn't at the start of the season, but in a lot of ways, it marks the start of the season. It's kind of got this essence for the Italian fans and even within Italian culture of kind of marking the start of spring, of you kind of start in the gloom and the fog of Milan first thing in the morning, and you kind of ride across the Piedmont Plain, and then you ride up the Turchino Pass through the tunnel at the top of the pass, and you kind of emerge. Sort of, you're above the Mediterranean at that point, but you kind of emerge into the sunlight, and suddenly there's like blossom on the trees. You just get this feeling of suddenly everything's changing. And that's essentially where the race changes its shape as well. They come down to the coast, and then you get this kind of astonishing ride along the Corniche, if you like it, along the coast through all these little coastal towns. The race is absolutely gripping then. It's spectacular to watch, and the scenery's spectacular as well.
I always thought it's quite a hard race to market in a way, because you have to be honest and say that not much happens for long, long periods. And then there are these a few small hills at the end. It's hardly got the epic scale of the Tour de France or the Giro d'Italia or even some of the other classics, which do have these signature big climbs or cobbled climbs. Yet at the same time, it just seems to work, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think because it is so different. One of the things that has struck me as I've thought about and watched San Remo more over the years is that it's kind of the essence of every bike race. For a lot of people who aren't fans, they look at a bike race and they think, well, not much is happening until they get near the finish. So why would I watch these early bits? And kind of San Remo captures that more than anything else. And I think it kind of shows, it's a mirror on the sport. For people who say, oh, I don't like San Remo, it's not a great race, I kind of think, well, San Remo is the race. This is what cycling is. This is the essence of it. This captures it better than any race. The fact that you get this sort of slow build-up. And I mean, San Remo, it's incredibly slow build-up. And then you just get this explosion of excitement at the end. And I don't think there are many races that kind of reach that same crescendo that San Remo does, because the build-up is so long and extended.
For me, that last 30 kilometres is maybe the best 30 kilometres of the year. It's the stretch of racing that you can absolutely guarantee that it's all going to happen there, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, as I say, you get this long build-up, and then you get to just over the Capi, I suppose, these three little headlands as they're approaching San Remo. I guess they're like 40, 50 kilometres away, and then they come to the Cipressa, the first of those two climbs. That's where you kind of think, this is the first chance that somebody's going to try something here. Somebody's going to think, I can't wait until the Poggio, I've got to attack. Other teams are going to be obviously chasing down those attacks. And it's just full on from that point. I mean, it's absolutely fascinating. And you see these pictures at the back of the bunch of, like, I don't know, people puncturing on the way into the Cipressa or something. And you think, that's it, your race is done, mate. That's the end of your day. You're never going to get back on now. Unless you're Arnaud Démare, of course. He did in 2016, but that's another story.
And who for you are the winners that have defined the race?
Well, got to be Eddy Merckx. I mean, won it seven times. It was the first big title he won when he turned pro, and he just kept coming back to it again and again. When this century started, it was very much still a sprinter's race. It was kind of known as a sprinter's classic, and that's really changed now. I mean, we have had sprinters. I mean, I mentioned Démare. I think he was actually the last sprinter to win it. But now it's become much more unpredictable. RCS, the organisers, I mean, they've been searching for years and years for this kind of magic formula to bring all these different types of riders into the mix. I mean, they threw in other climbs. Le Manier was one of them. And there was talk about taking up the Pompeiana, which is a climb before the Cipressa, I think. And they're trying to create this great formula so that you get the puncheurs coming in, you get the sprinters, the rouleurs, the great descenders. And we finally, in the last few years, seem to have got that. I mean, we're looking ahead to this weekend's race, and you think there's like maybe a dozen guys you would think are realistic contenders. And it's hard to see who the favourite might be.
And a bit like asking somebody to choose their favourite child, but do you have any favourite editions of Milan San Remo?
I think the one that... when I was writing the book back in 2013, I didn't go to all the monuments that year, but I went to most of them, and I think I missed Lombardy. And that was the year that they had the blizzard on the course, and they had to stop going up the Turchino. I was I was driving with Sophie Smith, one of our journalistic colleagues. We'd driven from Milan, and we were on the motorway next to the Turchino Pass in like a little Cinquecento or something. And I was saying to Sophie, I don't think I'm going to get up here. This is just like, this is a crazy amount of snow. We managed to get over the top, and we saw all the team buses coming back on the other side of the motorway, obviously going back to pick the riders up who'd stopped. And we carried on, and we got to San Remo, and we knew they'd kind of come down to the coast and they'd restarted. And then you had this, well, I mean, it was quite epic, the finale. I think that, if I remember rightly, Ian Stannard was right in the mix till quite late on in the race and was very close to kind of going all the way. Then there was a sprint at the end, and Gerold Ciolek, the German guy who was like tipped for really big things, just emerged from the pack and won it. He was riding for MTN Quebec then, and it was their first monument. I mean, I spoke to Doug Ryder in Milan that morning, and he said, for us, it's a victory just being in the race, being in Milan today. When I went to Doug in San Remo and tried to get some comment then, he was just, he couldn't speak. He was just completely speechless, having seen one of his riders win the race. But that's the one I remember, I suppose, most, that stands out most in my mind.
Thank you very much, Pete. So Pete's book, The Monuments, The Grit and Glory of Cycling's Greatest One-Day Races, has been updated, and the updated version is out now. So you should all go and buy it. You've just got time to read the Milan-San Remo chapter before Saturday's race. So that was our look at Milan-San Remo. And to conclude this show, I'm going to talk with Rachel Jarry about the Women's Classic season to come. So Rachel, the Women's Classic season is similar to, but not identical to, the men's season. What are the big races coming up?
Whether you could kind of call it a classic, I'm not sure, but Trofeo Binder takes place on the 19th. And I would say that is one of the longest running women's world tour races. It's not like a Belgian classic. It's quite hilly while rolling. It was won last year by Elisa Balsamo. So she's kind of more of a sprinter. So obviously it's not super hilly. And then after that, the women also race Nocere Coerse, which isn't world tour for them either. It's a one pro race, I think. And then they have Gent-Wevelgem, Flanders, Paris-Roubaix, and then obviously the trio of Ardennes Classics as well. So quite similar to the men's in that sense.
What are the big talking points for the 2023 Classic season?
I'd say probably the SD Works drama after Strada Bianchi and that sprint between Vollering and Capecchi that no one really expected. It's going to be quite interesting to see how they deal with that inter-team dynamic and those sort of rivalries. And we'll see, because there's obviously Lorena Wiebes, who's a good sprinter, who can be up there in these classics races if it comes down to a bunch sprint. But then at the same time, Lotta Capecchi, we know she's really keen to win and she's also got a fast finish. Vollering can go for the longer tack. So that's going to be a really interesting like team dynamic. And then I suppose everyone's looking at Van Vleuten as well to see if she'll come back to the form that we've seen her in at this time of year in the past. She's been a little bit off the mark following attacks and things. And then one rider I'm looking forward to watching is also Charlotte Kuhl, seeing how she can get on in these races. She had a really good start to the season at the UAE Tour, beating Lorena Wiebes in sprints. So we'll see if she can kind of convert that into the classics as well. And if she can get a big one day result, that would probably be a really kind of next step in her career.
And it's a recent phenomenon in the men's side that we started to see much more overlap between the tour stage race riders and one day riders. But it has always been thus in the women's side, hasn't it? You get the same racers kind of prominent in the stage races and the one day race. It's the side of the sport that suits the all rounders.
Yeah, I think it's kind of always had to be that way in women's cycling because there's smaller teams and a growing calendar. Teams generally want to sign riders who could do a bit of everything. They're not going to be like a sprinter who can't do any sort of climbing. They need someone who's a bit more of an all-rounder. And that's something I think it'll be interesting to see a change in the future if riders are allowed to specialise and be like a pure bunch sprinter on the women's side, because generally they're all looking to be more all-rounders so they can go for more results and they're more of an attractive proposition to teams. So yeah, it's really different in that sense, in that it's always been like the same riders could win the Giro d'Onna as the Tour of Flanders. It's quite different to the men's on that side, apart from Pogačar is obviously breaking all the rules about cycling on the men's side. But
I was reminding myself about last year's classic season. It was quite a mix of winners last year. There was Elisa Balsamo, as you said, had a great run of wins at Binder and Gent-Wevelgem, and Lotta Kopecky won Tour of Flanders, and then Marta Cavalli one Amstel and Flesch, but we still saw the more experienced riders like Longo Borghini and Van Vleuten. Longo Borghini won Paris-Roubaix and Van Vleuten won at Liège. So do you think that battle will tilt towards the younger riders, or do you think that riders like Van Vleuten's, you know, it's Van Vleuten's last season. Do you think she wants to go out on top?
I think with races like Roubaix and Flanders, experience plays a big part. Like knowing where those climbs are, knowing those roads, having raced it the amount of times that the likes of Van Vleuten has will make a really big difference. She's going to know when the important moves will go. She's going to know we need to be well positioned at the front. I think there will be young talent coming through, like people like Charlotte Sokol. But, you know, women's cycling does seem to have an older average age of riders who perform at a high level compared to the men's calendar. If you look at the top 10 from last year's Flanders, I think pretty much all of them were the more experienced riders. People like Utre Bluedwig, Cassino Adoma, Grace Brown, people, Bastianelli, people who'd been in the peloton for a long time. So I kind of expect that to continue. I was trying to think if I could think of any young riders who could upset things. But at the moment, I can't really think of anyone who I think's got a chance of winning who isn't somebody who's already quite an established name, apart from Charlotte Kuhl has a chance in the Flatter Classics, maybe. And then there's riders like Pfeiffer Georgie and Leanna Lippert, maybe, who are kind of on the edge of that big result. But whether they're at the level yet to kind of beat Capecchi or Van Vleuten or Vollering, I'm not sure it's going to be this year. Although I would love to see it. I always root for the underdog.
So Strade Bianche has been the best form guide we've had so far, probably more so for the hilly classics. And, you know, in that race, it was dominated by SD Works because Demi Vollering and Lotte Kopecky basically dropped everybody and contested the win. So Kopecky's currently dealing with a recent family tragedy, and understandably, she's got, you know, more important things to deal with. But Vollering looks in great shape. And do you see her as the rider to beat? Because in one way, she's shown her form, but on the other hand, she's never quite graduated to that very top level of being the outright favourite.
I know. I think this year, I feel like Vollering has become definitely an outright favourite. I think seeing that Van Vleuten's been performing at a lower level has just catapulted Vollering as the key favourite for a lot of these races. I think where she might struggle is kind of dealing with that pressure of being the pre-race favourite. She's a super emotional rider. Like at the end of the races, she really feels it. And I wonder if having that additional pressure of being a team leader will be a lot for her to handle. And I don't know if the kind of downfall of SD Works might be their own strength at some point. The fact that they've got all these strong riders, and could it be a case of them having too many cooks and not picking a particular rider to work for and sort of saying, oh, we'll see how it goes on the road, which worked at Strade Bianche. But will it work every single time? I don't know. Could that lack of cohesion be their downfall at some point? I don't know. We'll have to see. And Movistar as well have a really strong team, and they could definitely pose a big challenge if things go right for them on the day. So yeah, Vollering is definitely one to watch though, and she is going to be hard to beat, but it's not impossible, I'd say.
We will see. So Trofeo Alfredo Binder is this Sunday, 19th of March. Looking forward to the classic season getting underway and basically cancelling all my weekend activities till the end of April. You have been listening to Rouleau Conversations. Rouleau Conversations is made by the editorial staff of Rouleau magazine. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Rouleau and on Instagram at Rouleau magazine, or visit our website at rouleau.cc. This episode was produced by Amber Miller of Content is Queen.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.